Thanks for tuning in today. I'm Dr. Nick, the Incrementalist. Join me as I seek out the small incremental changes being applied in other industries that we can learn from and that can be applied in healthcare. Can these changes bring immediate value, but also add up to the big improvements and revolution we need in healthcare? Come along with me to explore the possibilities. My innovative guests from around the globe have used small incremental improvements to achieve their moonshot.
And today, I'm delighted to be joined by Dr. Cesar Javaharian. He is the medical director and co-founder of Carbon Health. Cesar, thanks for joining me today.
Yeah, thanks for having me on.
For the benefits of the listeners, I think it's important to sort of set your background. You are, in fact, an emergency room physician. Tell us a little bit about how you got to that and also your medical director function at Carbon Health and what Carbon Health is doing.
Oh, absolutely. Thank you. So I entered emergency medicine really because it's the broadest field in healthcare. So it touches on really every aspect of people's lives. And it's also the closest to the consumer. So you'll see people who are leading their daily lives. And then the next minute, they're coming in for healthcare. And it really provided incredible insight into what people needed. I connected that with my interest in data analytics and health technology, starting back in medical school, and had the wonderful opportunity to do residency at hospitals affiliated with Columbia University, where I did medical informatics research, and then later on focused on, you know, the electronic health record world, and really kind of started to get disappointed and disenchanted with what was going on in those enterprise solutions that were out there.
So I couldn't agree with you more. I think, you know, that ability to see, but it also gives you a window into the challenges in the healthcare system, because you see these folks who are essentially accessing healthcare through that emergency service. I imagine that's sort of driven some of where you've directed your efforts at this point.
Absolutely. So, you know, and I know you're an emergency room physician as well. So we've seen people wait hours and hours to get care that's much more expensive than it should be, at least for that individual, and have a terrible experience. So tons of money spent, bad patient experience, generally good patient care for things like emergencies, but you know, people find themselves in the ER because they can't access care elsewhere. So early on in residency, I realized that there was an opportunity to bridge that gap, where we could provide access points that were lower cost, that were, you know, better at taking care of people and their needs, to drive up satisfaction, and really kind of impact the cost curve, so that instead of going to the ER, which no one in their right minds would ever want to do, they could actually go to a nice clinic, get the care they need, have follow-up, understand what happened to them, communicate that with their primary care doctors. So we thought that was the gap that we could address.
So clearly this, the blending of both the emergency room, the informatics and technology coming together. Tell us a little bit about Carbon Health and what that organization is and does.
Wow, that's a great question. So Carbon Health is a dream come true. And I think every physician who I've ever talked to has the same dream, which is that instead of spending a bunch of our time doing administrative tasks, entering information to the electronic health record, we use technology to actually increase our efficiency at Carbon Health, to improve the patient encounter, to improve communication, and to really create a connection through the digital realm, because that's the lowest kind of the lowest kind of barrier to entry is using tech as opposed to using, you know, phone calls and people to make these things happen. So what we did at Carbon is we really rethought what the patient experience was, and then developed technology to make that experience easy. So I sometimes joke when you get trained on one of the enterprise systems like Epic or Cerner or Allscripts, you usually have to take a doctor out of service for a day,
at least
a half a day.
Right.
and explain to them, you know, how to put in an order set, the fact that they're clicking 10 times to order a simple medication, the fact that they have to specify when ordering Tylenol that it's not intrathecal, intramuscular, you know, because some engineer sat in the development world and thought about all the different ways a medication could be given and then connected it to all the different medications in the world. So I joke that instead of going through that experience, you know, we never expect to do that with Facebook or Instagram or any of the tech that doctors use day in and day out. We're not stupid as a class. It's just that the technology that we've been forced to use is actually difficult to use because it's, you know, it's created on old, you know, computer languages that require quite a bit of work on the user side. Now, if you rethink how electronic medical records can work and what an impact that can have on hospital operations, you know, that is what we're trying to address at Carbon Health as well, which is let's use modern computer technology to make it easy for doctors to understand how to do their day-to-day jobs and take out some of the inefficiencies that are inherent in healthcare delivery, which really translates to taking out costs to the system. And again, drive down costs without driving down doctor productivity or, you know, any of the other important components of the delivery model. So
it's interesting you bring that up, and, you know, that training point is important, because can you imagine how successful the iPhone would have been if it had required a full day of training to take place? And I know that's a little bit trivial, but, you know, the point is, it's important. It's this idea of sort of facile use. And we saw huge numbers of devices coming into facilities because they were great. They were the iPhones and the, you know, the mobile devices, because all the physicians said, wow, this is fantastic. I use it at home. I want to use it here. So love that sort of concept. Now, the world has changed a little in the last few months. And I think you've found yourself at the nexus of COVID-19 as a result of this technology innovation, the idea of making things valuable and easy to use. Tell us a little bit about what's going on there for Carbon Health and some of the things that you've been involved in around COVID-19.
So we had our first concerning patient in our Mountain View clinic come in on January 23rd of 2020. So we have a communication network with all of our providers through Carbon, through our proprietary EMR. And this clinician said, you know, I have a young woman from Wuhan City presenting with tachycardia and fever. What should I do? And again, this is January 23rd. Where we had just been learning a bit about what was going on in China and some other countries in, you know, in Asia. And so we had an immediate response to that. What was particularly scary is that about an hour and a half later, that same clinician again messaged us with the emoji with the tears coming down. And it said, you'll never believe this. I have another patient with the exact same story.
Wow.
So we had two patients in Santa Clara County, and actually it corresponds to really when the first cases started to show up. It may have been our cases that were identified by public health. But as soon as we saw that, we realized that as an organization, we had to adapt to the world of coronaviruses everywhere. And this was before widespread testing was available. This is before coronavirus kind of dominated national news. But the advantages that we had as a healthcare organization and as a technology company was that in a matter of days, we had our engineers in the same space as our doctors, providers, our marketing team, our product team, to really start to think about how does an organization respond to a pandemic? And you can imagine there are operational concerns because we have employees who we were absolutely worried about, who are on the front lines. And we also had the ability, though, then to say, the first step is to risk stratify people before they walk in. So we created, we think, the country's first symptom tracker. Before patients were able to come into the clinic, as part of their intake, they would answer questions about travel history, which was important back then. It's no longer relevant. They would answer questions about their symptoms. And before they even entered the clinic, our staff would know that there was a concerning patient coming in. So they would be masked, gloved. They would insist on the patient being masked. Again, we're talking about, you know, late January, early February for these changes. So since that time, and as a reminder, widespread coronavirus testing started to become available in mid-March. So as soon as that was available, we were obviously, you know, first in line to start testing patients. We've now tested over 200,000 patients in our organization. And through that testing, we've had zero staff contract the virus from patients. So 200,000 cases, zero frontline healthcare workers contracting the virus. And I would argue that our technology played a key role in making that happen. But it wasn't just the tech. It wasn't just the doctors. It was all of us working together to make it happen and make it a safe work environment.
For those of you just joining, I'm Dr. Nick, the incrementalist. And today I'm talking to Dr. Cesar Javaharian. He is the medical director and co-founder for Carbon Health. We were just talking about their sort of early alerting system and how they identified pretty much with, you know, certainly one of the very first cases that was identified here in the United States. And my question around that is, what do you think it was that allowed your organization to bubble that up to the top where others, I don't think, did? I mean, they missed some of those signals. What was going on in the configuration, the technology? What allowed Carbon Health to see that and start to respond in such a positive way?
Well, we're incredibly fortunate that, first of all, we are free thinkers at the company. So we're not bogged down by the idea that we've always done X this way. We also don't have a multiple layered management system so that by the time that a clinician sees something on the front lines, it might be a month later before management hears about it. So we've created very much an organization where everyone's input is important. In fact, even, you know, much before the coronavirus crisis, we have a no people policy at work. And, you know, since you're in healthcare, you know that that is novel. People in operations and hospitals are always like, wait, you guys really have a no people policy, meaning that the doctors can't be mean to staff? We're like, yeah, we've actually had to let people go.
Right.
But what it does is, you know, it's really evidence-based. So we know that malpractice rates are higher in environments where people can't, you know, can't speak up. We know that satisfaction rates are lower for patients. And we didn't want our organization to be bogged down by that. So what made us different was that we had an ear to what was going on in, you know, in a very much kind of technology-driven fashion, where what people see on the front lines immediately comes to all the layers of management. That was true when we had one clinic in Berkeley. It's true today where we're in, you know, almost 40 states and take care of 500,000, you know, people a year, growing at 900% year over year. So because we were able to kind of early on get the right people in the room and not have a mentality of, oh, that's dangerous. Oh, can we really get that through legal? Do we need to have so-and-so sign off on this? We were able to move fast. I would never, ever, ever look down on other organizations for not being able to move quickly, because we've all been a part of these large mm-hmm. academic institutions or community health, community hospitals, where everyone's intentions are 100% correct, but there are legacy problems, there are political issues that they're dealing with, and they're providing healthcare to a broad range of people, from cancer care to, you know, outpatient services. So we're lucky that we were focused on outpatient services, urgent care, primary care, mental health, women's health. We have some specialty care services, but everyone who enters our organization has the same idea of just doing what's right for the patients without having to, you know, have an executive sign off on it. So I think that's, you know, that was the main reason that we were successful at it. But as we grow, it is our number one goal to maintain that culture. The other thing that I would say is that, you know, we actually work with local hospitals to take our strengths and impart them onto their system. So our Mountain View Clinic is run with El Camino Health, as an example. And so the knowledge that we were able to obtain on January 23rd, we conveyed to that health system, you know, by early February, and we're working together to take care of that community. It's a long-winded answer to your question, but I thought it was important to go through that.
No, I think it's important. And, you know, you highlight something that's also important here is that, you know, without baggage, it's easier to sort of innovate and, you know, apportioning blame is almost a pointless task unless it's, you know, to the benefit of learning from it to, you know, improve on it. And it's easy to sort of cast aspersions, but I come from this perspective that everybody is here trying to do the right thing. They just don't always have the opportunity to, and you have to find that pathway. And, you know, that's evidently true in this environment. What happened as a result of that, you got to the forefront of testing, which, you know, right now seems to be one of the major focal points. We haven't done a terribly good job here in the United States. Tell us a little bit about what's going on and where you see that going and the opportunities for, you know, improvements.
Yeah, well, I think you would agree that part of the deficiency is that we lack really a federal response to the testing strategy, that we lack strong guidelines to make testing available, strong guidelines to reduce spread. I think the idea of leaving it up to states and counties is short-sighted because, you know, they have county public health is some of the greatest people from the healthcare world enter that world, and they had limited capacity before the pandemic, right, and now you throw in, you know, a once in 100-year pandemic at them and expect them to adjust. That's just impossible. So, you know, testing for us is actually a fairly important, but not at all at the core of what we do. So, you know, if we had some regulatory changes, we could unlock a lot of test capacity at university academic centers, where if I could send a sample to Stanford or UCSF or New York Presbyterian and have them run in their own laboratories a coronavirus test and make sure that lab gets paid by insurance providers, even though they're not necessarily contracted to take outside samples, I think that would make a huge impact in unlocking a lot of capacity. What we've done is we've focused on time of test results. So that turnaround time has been an important driver of the types of tests that we've chosen to work with. So we rely heavily on Abbott's RapidNow or Rapid ID test. We also work with regional laboratories like Westpac, national ones like LabCorp and Quest. But again, a lab test where the result comes back 5 to 7 days later highlights that you cannot have a test-only strategy to holding this pandemic. you really need to focus on education and prevention. The best way of focusing on prevention is not to say, hey, everyone, try to be responsible, because you're dealing with humans, and humans have a false sense of security when they're not having symptoms. We all know this because we treat people with hypertension all the time, right?
Right.
You have a patient with like blood pressure of 220 over 150 come in, and you're like, sir, I really think you should start a blood pressure medicine. And what's always their first response?
I feel fine.
Yeah, exactly. I feel fine. Like, I mean, and the person absolutely feels fine until they have a massive stroke.
Right.
Or until they come into the ER with kidney failure. And so, so humans being humans, we're going to do as much as we can, as long as we feel fine, unless someone from above says, listen, there's a lockdown and we're going to all lock down for 2 months or 3 months. It's going to hurt for that period of time. But believe me, it will be the fastest way to reopen our economy, just as New Zealand did.
Right. Yeah, it's funny. I'd use that. They're obviously the one of the best examples, because they really are open. They've got almost negligible. I know they had a couple of cases show up recently. We're running out of time, and I want to give you an opportunity to talk about the data science of this, because really at the core, and I hear this a lot, is the value of data-driven decision-making that we seem to struggle with. Tell us a little bit about that.
So it was the data science component of healthcare that prompted me to really go into, you know, the startup world. So fresh graduated from medical school, right around just after the technology innovation in Silicon Valley, where, you know, you could now buy a stock through your computer or search whatever you wanted on Google. And I thought that the most important industry to apply technology to would be healthcare. What I realized very quickly is that data in healthcare really don't get along. It's too fragmented. We don't have a national standard on how to even document things like blood pressure or glucose or right. So if you dive deep into some of the enterprise systems, you see there are 5 or 6 or 8 different ways of just documenting blood pressure. Is it arterial? Is it left arm? Is it leg? All these various ways that make it kind of useless. So the data science component of what we do is, using modern technology, we identify usable, actionable data when our patients come in for care. And we have an entire data science team that can look at not just trends, but statistically significant trends. So I can tell you that in our data set of 200,000 patients who've been tested for coronavirus, you know, when information came out of NYU about potentially the Abbott tests being inferior to commercial tests, or that nasopharyngeal swab, so that really painful deep nasal swab, is the right way to go versus oropharyngeal or anterior nasal, we were able to ask our data scientists, is that true? In our experience, looking at our information, is it true? And it turns out that neither of those was true. Mm. That the anterior nasal, the more comfortable one, was not inferior to nasopharyngeal, was not inferior, and the Abbott test was not inferior to the laboratory test. So we were able to make meaningful decisions based on real world examples. And then we apply this type of data science to people's individual health. So, you know, can we identify what an asymptomatic carrier looks like when they then test positive? And the answer is yes, we absolutely can. We have 200,000 people in our data set. Just as a reminder for the audience, like, a massive study in healthcare might include 10,000 patients. The biggest ones in cardiology, which are the best funded studies, are upwards of 60,000 patients. You know, we can, in our tiny, tiny organization of 300 people, we've got a couple hundred thousand just in coronavirus. Think about all the other things we can look at.
Fantastic. Well, as usual, unfortunately, we've run out of time. I think, fascinating deep dive into the opportunities that we have in this current pandemic. Just remains for me to thank you for joining me, Cesar. It's been a delight. Thanks for joining me today.
Thank you so much. It's been a real pleasure to talk to you.
Thanks for joining me today. Do you have any better ideas, or have you found a small incremental change that's brought about a big improvement in your world? Let's continue the conversation on our hashtag, TheIncrementalist, or share with me at DrNick1 on Twitter. You can find more information about the show on our program page at healthcarenowradio.com. And tune in next time to hear my discussions with leaders and innovators from around the globe who've revolutionized their space by using small incremental improvements to achieve their moonshot. I'm Dr. Nick, the Incrementalist, and I'm starting a revolution through evolution.